Coming up on Golf Today, Spieth happens. The Golden Child is on the golf course at Wailea hunting for birdies in round one of the Sony Open in Hawaii, and we have the highlights to prove it. And putting guru Brad Faxon has a win at Wailea. It happened 22 years ago, so we thought it wise to invite Fax on for a past champ chat. Plus, with all the noise about the new official World Golf ranking system, why not speak to the man who wrote the algorithm? He's Mark Brody. Grab a pencil and paper. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today.
High above Oahu as the first round of the Sony Open is underway at Wailea Country Club, and the PGA Tour completes its two-week stretch in the 50th state of Hawaii. Scores already. The players are making some birdies, going low. Chris Kirk, runner-up to Kevin Na a couple of years ago, 6-under through 14. Stewart Cink, forever young at the age of 49, just two shots back. This is Golf Today. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. It's going to be a very brainy show on this Thursday. A couple of professors, I understand, are joining the program.
It's a shame we didn't listen to those professors, you know, back in when we were in school, Damon. How different life could have been if we'd only paid as much attention then as we do now.
Yeah, tell you what, I'm going to show a lot of pretty pictures in addition to getting a little smarter on this Thursday. How about this two-week stretch from Kapalua to Wailea? And the test is going to be a little bit different than we saw last week, where we saw 30-under. This is going to be a little bit different, maybe a little sterner test, at least I hope.
It's a significant adjustment for both player and caddy. There was over 400 feet of elevation change at Kapalua last week. There's almost none here at Wailea. It's pretty much right there on the ocean floor. So it's going to be an interesting adjustment for caddies and players to try to figure out their way around it. But it seems it's doable because 8 of the last 9 winners of the Sony Open played the week before at the Century. Of course, that they're already elite players by virtue of the fact that they are playing at the Century. But I think a little game sharpness actually counts for a lot this week.
And it's the first full field event of 2023. I imagine some sharp elbows a little bit. You want to measure yourself against your peers, kind of see where they are and where you are at the start of 2023.
And at the first full field event of the year, there are a lot of people who are still trying to, who maybe got a little momentum during the fall series, are looking to keep that up. Other guys who didn't get that are looking to hit a reset button. So everyone's got something to prove here early in the year.
Before we look ahead, let's look back. I want to go back to 2013. Do you remember the Sony Open in Hawaii? There was a certain Georgia Bulldog, Russell Henley, making a lot of noise in his first professional start as a member of the PGA Tour. He went nuts, folks. 5 birdies to close out his first ever win on the PGA Tour, 24 under, 363s in 4 rounds, 256 total, by the way, was a tournament record until broken by Justin Thomas in 2017. And then Matt Kuchar, another notable winner of this event, 2019, he shot 22 under to beat Andrew Putnam by 4. Kuchar made 5 birdies on the back 9 Sunday, and now Kuchar and Russell Henley are out on the golf course with Tom Hoagie. Hopefully Tom Hoagie feeling a little bit better after that TCU defeat. With more from Wailea, let's welcome in Todd Lewis. Todd, looks gorgeous out there, but what are the conditions the players are facing today and moving forward?
Well, mahalo and aloha, guys. The wind is blowing. We're near the ocean here, and you can see the wind pushing my shirt a bit. But it's interesting, this golf course, only really 2 holes are on the water, and that is 16 and 17. This golf course is basically tree-lined, so that's going to block a lot of the wind. Secondly, as you look at the forecast, we've already seen the highest winds for the day. As we move through the afternoon, the winds are going to decrease to about 5 to 10 miles per hour. And look at that forecast through the rest of this week. It's going to be dry. The wind is going to lay down Friday and Saturday. Now, Sunday is different. It's going to be windier, probably the windiest day of the week, 15 to 20 miles per hour, and possibility of showers, but no real significant rain threat. But what it's doing to this golf course, it is drying it out. It was already fairly dry prior to this week, but as the week has progressed, not a lot of water has been thrown on it. This golf course is not only firm, it is getting fast. It's not a very long golf course, so that's not an issue as far as distance goes, but what the issue is here is that there are so many dog legs on this golf course. The players have to judge the right club they use off the tee not to roll through the dog leg and into the rough that's 3 inches right now. And these greens are going to firm up too. So rollout judgment is going to be a big key as play continues today. But this afternoon, the wind's going to lay down. You could see some lower scores.
Speaking of this afternoon, Todd, we're watching the early wave out there right now. Is there a group this afternoon that is getting your attention?
Yeah, there is a group, and they're going off in just about an hour or so, and Sung J.M., Adam Scott, and Hideki Matsuyama. Let's talk about these three players. Sung J.M. recently got married in December in his home country of Korea, finished in the top 15 last week over on Maui. There's Adam Scott, who's playing probably more than 20 events on the PGA Tour this year, which is remarkable if you consider that his family base is in Switzerland. Actually, from here, he's going to go home to Australia's home country, I should say, with his family. And then there is Hideki Matsuyama. Remember what he did last year? Shot 63-63 on the weekend. Had that incredible shot on Sunday at 18. The three-wood into the sun. Nearly lost a couple of rods and cones in his eye as he hit that shot. Looked away. And that propelled him to go on to get the victory here. And it was a huge win because there's such a Japanese influence in Honolulu. But Hideki has been bothered by a neck issue that really started in Orlando at Bay Hill at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, and it plagued him throughout the remainder of 2022. He's seen several doctors, actually flew home to Tokyo to see doctors there as well. It bothered him in the fall. He had to pull out of the Houston Open. He had to pull out of the Hero World Challenge. He did play last week, but he played without a lot of practice because his neck will not allow him to do so. And he hasn't been practicing a ton here this week. He is going to try to play, but I get the feeling he doesn't really trust his neck and his body right now. So I'd be surprised if he goes out and shoots a really low number today. He might gut it through, make the cut on the weekend. But there's always that saying, guys, beware of the injured golfer. So Hideki Matsuyama is going to be an interesting story through this week.
No doubt. A number of great players dealing with injury early in 2023. Xander Schauffele and Hideki Matsuyama as well. Great stuff. From Todd Lewis, we have more highlights for you now. How about Stuart Sink, 49 years young, 8-time winner on the PGA Tour. This is the par 3 for Thamon Lynch.
62 feet from the hole. That's almost as many years as he has on the clock.
How about that? For the major championship winners. Last PGA Tour win, 2021 RBC Heritage. You see, he dropped the shot, the par 4, 13th hole, currently sits at minus 4, 12 of 13 greens in regulation. So far, another look at the leaderboard, round one of the Sony Open. You see Chris Kirk, you may recall back in 2021, was on his final start of a major medical, needed a two-way T3 or better to retain his card. Remarkably finished T2 to keep his card. He leads by two.
Well, coming up, there's a court hearing tomorrow in the Northern District of California that pits the PGA Tour against the Saudi Public Investment Fund and its governor, who doesn't want to be deposed in LIV's antitrust lawsuit. Golf Channel's legal analyst, Jody Balsam, will be here right after the break to explain exactly what's at stake.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
More highlights from the Sony, the world number 15, Jordan Spieth, par 4, third, his second.
Just 133 yards. We're seeing a theme here, Damon. He's putting it inside the makeable range.
Yeah, the wind not bothering Jordan Spieth. Hits that to 8 feet, would make birdie, get to 4 under. 17 putts so far. Half the fairways, this looks like a Jordan Spieth type round. It's not always going to be straight, not always perfect, but he is 4 deep so far through his first 12 holes.
Well, Damon, earlier this week, a judge in California's Northern District refused a request to delay a hearing on whether the PGA Tour can obtain discovery from the Saudi Public Investment Fund and the fund's governor, Yasser Al-Rumian. The Tour says that discovery is crucial to its defense in the antitrust case brought by LIV Golf, which is funded by the investment fund. The Saudis are resisting and claiming immunity. And here's a timeline of how this legal action has begun. It started in August when 11 LIV players filed the antitrust suit against the PGA Tour. We went through the temporary restraining order. Later that month, LIV joined the antitrust suit. And here we are, January 11th. A judge denied a request to delay this hearing on discovery, which is actually scheduled for tomorrow morning in California. We're pleased to be joined now by Golf Channel's legal analyst and antitrust expert, Jody Balsam, sports law professor at Brooklyn Law School. Jody, can you explain in layman's terms exactly what this hearing tomorrow is about?
Tomorrow's hearing deals with discovery. That's where parties get to demand documents and testimony from each other and also from non-parties in advance of trial. So tomorrow's hearing is going to address the PGA Tour's request for discovery from a non-party, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which is the financial backer of LIV Golf. The PGA Tour wants this information from the Saudis because it believes that their involvement in LIV Golf's launch and in recruiting the golfers who defected from the PGA Tour is crucial to their antitrust defense and to their pursuit of tortious interference of contract charges against LIV Golf. The Saudis have refused to comply with any discovery requests or to deliver Mr. Al-Rumayyan for a deposition.
I'm curious what you think the Saudi resistance is to this one, Jody. I mean, they've made this argument for international comedy in the sense that Saudi government officials ought not to be subject to United States laws. Is that a viable argument here, or is there more at stake for the Saudis in this particular hearing than it might seem?
Well, they've made a few legal arguments. The principal one is the one you've described under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. To respect international relations, we do not compel foreign governments to jurisdiction of our courts. However, there is an exception in that act, and as a matter of international law, where a foreign government has proactively pursued commercial activity in another nation, and that commercial activity results in litigation, they must subject themselves to the jurisdiction of that court. That's what the Saudi fund has done here. In backing and directing the activities of LIV Golf, they have engaged in commercial activity in the United States that should remove any immunity from our jurisdiction. They also make the arguments that the discovery requested in this case is unduly burdensome, that as a non-party, they should be entitled to a narrower, less burdensome mode of discovery. And they also finally claim in the alternative that they don't actually have any relevant documents or information to produce, a claim that frankly is less than credible.
Well, which side in your mind has the better argument in your estimation, at least at this point?
Sure. Well, the PGA Tour to me has the better argument for a number of reasons. First, I think the commercial activity exception to foreign sovereign immunity is particularly strong in this case. There's a lot of record evidence of the Saudi investment fund's activities in the United States pertaining not only to its investment in LIV Golf, but to other investments. And indeed, LIV Golf has conceded the substantial involvement of the Saudi fund in the running of its business. Its complaint mentions the public investment fund on numerous occasions, and it has already disclosed documents in discovery to the PGA Tour that note that the Saudi investment fund has veto power over many of LIV Golf's business decisions. And there's also a sort of common sense argument here that will appeal to the judge. Here we have a foreign country, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, seeking protection of a U.S. court in the form of invoking our antitrust laws to gain recourse against a violator in the form of the PGA Tour, right? That's their argument. They can't turn around and disclaim the court's authority to compel discovery from them. And I would note that back in August, when the litigation began, the LIV Golf insisted on an expedited trial schedule. They insisted on the urgency of their claims and the need to have them quickly resolved. And the court extracted from them a promise that they would assist in that expediting the trial by guaranteeing the cooperation of the Saudi Public Investment Fund in any discovery that might be required of them. LIV Golf has now broken that promise, and that won't sit well with the judge.
Well, does a ruling either way have an impact on the broader lawsuit?
Well, a ruling in favor of the PGA Tour will move the lawsuit along more quickly, right? It will allow them to gain the discovery that they need. On the other hand, a ruling in favor of the Saudi government will delay any access to information that the PGA Tour needs to mount its defense. And frankly, a ruling in favor of either party could lead to further delay because the parties have the right to appeal this ruling to the court itself. This proceeding tomorrow is actually being held in front of a magistrate judge to whom all matters relating to discovery has been delegated. Whichever way she rules, we might well see an appeal to the presiding judge in the case, Judge Lapson.
Jody, what is the scope, potentially, of discovery here that would have the Saudi Public Investment Fund so resistant to the idea of subjecting its chairman, Yasser Al-Rumian, to that discovery? Could it go beyond just simply their day-to-day role in LIV Golf and have implications beyond that?
To me, there are a number of possible motivations for the Saudis' resistance to discovery that they essentially promised through their proxy, LIV Golf, to deliver back in August. One is this possibility of buyer's remorse here. I think the Saudis miscalculated when they decided to fund this lawsuit, not realizing how deep they would be dragged into the muck of American adversarial litigation and our very permissive pretrial discovery rules. I also think that they're concerned about what discovery might unearth beyond what is relevant, directly relevant to this lawsuit. There may be items they'd rather not reveal, like details about other investments, both known to the public and stealth investments, and also their involvement in an attempt to influence U.S. politics through their association with the Trump Organization. And I will also point out that Mr. Al-Rumayyan submitted an affidavit in the setting that we're going to see argued tomorrow opposing this discovery, in which he pointed out that Saudi penal laws will result in his 20-year incarceration if he intentionally divulges any information that the Saudi government deems to be classified. So there's a lot at stake here for Mr. Al-Rumayyan personally.
Wow. Jody, what is the likelihood of a ruling tomorrow?
Like I said, I think the court is very interested in proceeding at, frankly, breakneck speed for an antitrust lawsuit. There may well be a ruling from the bench, but because magistrate rulings are subject to further review by the district judge herself, this magistrate judge is likely to want to reduce her ruling to writing in a form that can be readily reviewed and reconsidered on any appeal. So we may see a tentative ruling in court tomorrow, followed by a later full-form written decision.
What are the next stages then in this action, Jody? If leaving aside this particular cul-de-sac that we've gone into here over discovery, in terms of the broader antitrust trial, what are the next stages that we should look for?
Well, I think the timeline for this antitrust trial is very much in doubt right now. The judge had set the parties on a course to arrive at trial in January of 2024, only a year away. Considering that most antitrust litigation takes 3 to 4 years to get to trial, and given the amount of delay and dissension in the discovery process, I think it's very unlikely we'll see a trial in 2024 at all.
Well, sounds like tomorrow's another big day in this case. Jody, thank you so much for your time. We'll talk to you soon. Back on golf today, gorgeous shot. Sony Open in Hawaii is the first full-field event. The PGA Tour in 2023. You see the scores. Chris Kirk currently leads by one over Jordan Spieth. And fantastic leaderboard already. First round coverage coming your way, 7 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. Now, 22 years ago, Brad Faxon fired a final round 65 to finish at 20 under par and secure his seventh career win on tour, tied the tournament scoring record, took home the largest winner's check of his career at the time in the process. And man, took it deep, but he just played out of his mind in a three-shot lead through 54 holes, final round 65 to win by four, made eagle in each of the four rounds that week, played eight par five holes in 11 under par. I actually thought that was a typo. It was not. So it's time now for a past champs chat with Brad Faxon. Brad, first of all, congrats on your new role as part of the coverage team with golf on NBC. What are you most looking forward to?
Well, thanks, Damon. Eamon, nice to see you guys. You know, I think it's getting back to broadcasting golf in the U.S. The last couple of years, I've been doing Sky Sports over in the U.K. And now with a chance to work for some of the best tournaments NBC does all year long, going to start at the Honda Classic when the swing moves back to Florida. And you know where NBC starts there at the Honda, which is right down the street from where I live. And hopefully, you know, work with the great team at NBC. You know, I talked to Paul Azinger the other day, who was out in Hawaii last week, and he's so excited. I'm excited. And I think we're ready to start coverage once everybody moves to Florida.
Brad, it's nice to see you're fortifying yourself as you normally do whenever you actually have to talk to me. But where exactly are you at the moment?
That's probably a good question to anybody that's watching the show right now. But I'm at the Buzzard Bay Brewery, which is about a stone's throw away, or maybe about three drives that hit the road and might get to my dad's house for you, Eamon. This is his favorite watering hole. It's a place that the locals in the winter come to, the Buzzard Bay Brewery. And you can see the kind of cool artwork and stuff they have here. But my friend Harry Smith, who's an avid golfer and my father's closest friend, is right over here watching. And it's a place where in the wintertime when you lived up here, you had to find a place to go and watch golf, because if you weren't in Hawaii when you lived up here, you were just wishing you were in Hawaii. So that's where I am.
A few years ago, whenever we were deeper into a bottle of wine in your house, I asked you what was the best golf you ever played at any point during your career. And you said it was that Sony Open you won. Why was that?
Well, if you looked at that leaderboard, I think, well, and particularly that week, but if you look at the leaderboard, the current leaderboard, when you see Kirk and Spieth, there's a handful of young players, older players. There's some guys that draw the ball, hit the ball left to right. There's guys that hit it long and hit it short that can do well at Wailea. And I rarely did any of those as well, but it's a course where hitting in the fairway is a premium. And when I said it was the best golf I ever played, I had a couple things go great that week. I hit a lot of fairways, which was rare for me. Coming out of that Bermuda rough on the smaller greens was tough. And I was hitting the ball well, and I had a good pattern. I was drawing the ball well, and you hit a lot of shots in crosswinds there, and you have to rely on at least one stable sort of shot. And then I putted extremely well there. You know, it's the only course I think left on the tour where you're playing out of common Bermuda fairways. The course had been reduced a year or two before from par 72 to par 70. And Damon, when you play back the stats from my par five play that week, I eagled one hole every round that week and finished that last putt you showed at the beginning was for eagle to shoot 260, which was 20 under, and played the last two rounds with Ernie Els, who was one of the best players in the world then, and Tom Lane. So I played with some pressure and to win that tournament and to win by four. I don't know if I could ever play any better.
You mentioned Ernie, Tom Lehman was chasing you. You said everything went as planned, went as expected, and sometimes even better. Didn't you hole some frightening chip shot on two? What do you remember about that?
Well, I was going to go to two, and there's another great memory from number 10. But on the second hole, which is one of the toughest drives, I pushed my drive well to the right. The pin was right over a bunker that you had the players have to carry to get to that hole location. And I played the safe shot pretty far left, and it ended up on top of some Bermuda grass. Now that rough can get pretty wiry, and the wire in the ball can go down. And it's one of those chip shots that I could play a little bit back, keep the face square. It was with my 58 degree, which was my most lofted club, and it landed on the green. It just rolled the whole way in for a putt. And I remember Ernie was kind of in the background, and I just saw his head go up in the air like, oh no, not lucky can this guy be, because I should have made a five. And I walked away with a three and getting the honor on the third tee. But you know, my dad's not doing great right now. He's got some cancer issues going on, and he's working hard to do whatever he can. And I know he's probably watching right now, but my stepmother, his wife Eileen, who was watching on TV, she reminded me of how this shot I hit on the 10th hole hit one of the palm trees, and instead of rolling back into the rough or in the bunker, kicked onto the green and made a nice par there. So, you know, when you win, good things happen. You get a lot of lucky breaks. And I think for anybody watching, or any players that have aspirations of getting better, you know, sometimes those things are out of your control, and they just, you have to allow them to happen. And I got pretty fortunate that week.
Well, we hope Brad Sr. is watching and that this is putting a smile on his face. 0-1 also, you know, you said, I mean, the game was becoming the game of the long hitter. You had Tiger, Daly, Phil, Ernie, Vijay in that era. But you wanted to play in the Masters, and this win kind of kept you in that top 50. You played very well that April. How much was that front of your mind that you wanted to make sure that you were driving a car down Magnolia Lane in 2001?
Well, my wife Dory and I got married in 2000. She had seen me win, and Eamon hates when I say this, two of the most important wins of my career were those back-to-back BC Open wins. And Dory was there for one of those. And to win while we were married, to be able to get into the Masters, which, you know, every player, when they win, they know that's coming. And that was a big deal for us, a big deal for her. And, you know, you get in the Masters and there's, I don't think there's a more proud feeling. And watching now all these players that receive the invitation in the mail, posting them on social media, that was a big deal to me. And, you know, world ranking points were just starting to grow and gain popularity, and getting in that top 50 and staying there was huge.
Brad, it's been 40 years since you joined the PGA Tour. You're still steeped in it day to day. You spend a lot of time around the top players in the world. Do you think somebody going out there now with the skill set that you had could be competitive, or has the game valued raw power over everything else?
Yeah, you'd have to, you know, pick and choose a little bit better than maybe I did. I never went out there, Eamon, with any thoughts that I couldn't play a particular course well. And if I look back at my career, the really, you know, the courses that were supposedly too long for me, I still managed to play well when I had not just my game together, but my head together, and not letting what some experts wanted to tell me would or could work or couldn't work. Certainly, the game is so much different. And, you know, if you go look back to 2000, when the Pro V1 was first introduced, and, you know, the game sort of changed then, where launch angles had to change to maximize distance. Players now, all of them are doing conditioning to hit the ball farther, whether it's conditioning on their bodies, their swing, their technologies that they have. I love it. I love what's going on with the game. I think this phrase, we got to get back to golf courses that we can play that by reducing or changing equipment, really ticks me off, because obsolescence has been around a long time. The game's never been more popular than it is right now. And I think that the coolest thing about PGA Tour and golf is when you go and play with the amateurs, and they want to measure how they're doing against the professional, right? Hey, I hit a 6-iron on the green, and Faxon hit a 4-iron, or, you know, we hit the same iron and we were, the tees were close together. That was something that I think brought the player and the amateurs together, where they can measure with this handicap system and have some sort of equality, and bring us where we could do what other sports couldn't do. And you know what? Today's 8-iron is like yesterday's 6-iron, maybe 5-iron with lofts and shafts and balls. I don't think it really makes a difference. These players are still so talented. If you did do a throwback event, players will find a way to make it work. But I wouldn't change a thing right now.
But isn't there any concern when you're seeing Hideki a year ago cut that corner on 18, hit that 3-wood a couple of feet with the sun going down, and guys taking these angles that we've never seen before? Are you a little bit wistful, concerned about maybe us losing some of the cozy confines of the PGA Tour?
Yeah, you know, part of me is like, yeah, it would be cool to see, you know, a 1-iron into 18 at Marion. But when Justin Rose won the Open back in 13, he hit an unbelievable drive and a 4-iron. And like I said, that 4-iron he had would have been today's equivalent of the 1-iron. He hit a shot better than Hogan did. I've never played with an amateur, particularly Eamon, that says I'm quitting this game because it's too easy. Eamon quits it because it's too hard. So, no, I'm not really wistful with that. I mean, I look at the scoring. Scoring really hasn't changed that much. I'm intrigued by some things. Why hasn't it changed? Why hasn't the putting statistics gotten better? Agronomy is certainly one of those technologies that's gotten way better over the last few years. Putting numbers haven't got particularly better is the reason why. And how do you stop the athlete? How do you stop them from training? And what percentage of distance gains are you going to put in each category, Damon? I mean, where are you going to rank the ball? So if you're going to reduce it by these numbers that I'm hearing from the different organizations are 10 or 12%, how do you just do this and think that the game's going to work going forward? If this is only going to happen for the elite level, how do you define the elite level? Is this going to be high amateur golf? Is it going to be low level professional golf, college golf? I think there's a lot of questions that have to be answered before we make any changes. And the big question, why are we trying to do that?
This is why we have to drink when we're each other's company all the time, because we don't actually agree on anything. Well, Brad's going to stick around for a little bit. He's going to go to work on that beer and come back and talk some more after the break. So stay with us.
Back on Golf Today, we continue our conversation with Brad Faxon. We're back at his career, first career win, Buick Open 1991. He chipped back in a playoff in Michigan. Chip could ball. Look at young Brad. How about 2005, what's now known as the Travelers Championship, final PGA Tour victory in a playoff as well. First playoff hole with a birdie, tied the course record. Final round of 61, and Brad was rolling very hard to beat. You see the 8 wins, 12-stroke comeback over final 36 at that Travelers, two-time member of the Ryder Cup, 4 top 10 finishes in majors, the best of 5th. 1995 PGA Championship. Brad joins us once again. You know, you're a putting whisperer to Rory and so many others, but I'm curious, how'd you develop into a great putter yourself? Born? Made?
Well, I think there might be some genetics there. I was lucky when I grew up. I had a family that was into golf. Great-grandfather, I found out today, was a good golfer. My grandfather was very good golf course, owned a golf course on Cape Cod. My father, his brother, and sister all played well, won junior, state junior level tournaments, club championships. And I found out another thing today. My dad won the club championship at Rhode Island Country Club in 65 and 66. I later won there when I was a senior in high school in 79. I won another club championship at a club he was a member at that same year. And then 3 years later, he won the club championship at that club. So we've won dual father and son club championships in a different order. And I'm kind of thinking that hasn't been done a lot either. So it's kind of cool being able to say that, hopefully with my dad watching.
Brad, we've had this conversation about the number of teachers that you've seen during the course of your career, probably even more than me. And I remember you went to the TPI facility once and they asked you to write a list of the teachers you had paid for lessons, and that list ran into the 60s, as I recall. Seeing that many teachers obviously helps as a broadcaster and a teacher because you've that experience, but do you think looking back it hurt you as a player?
Without a doubt. I never had lessons as a kid growing up. When I went to college, you know, other than the occasional keep your head down, stay behind it sort of stuff, all of it was from imitation or figuring out by yourself, or, you know, just watching players you liked. But in college, my junior year, we went to play a tournament down at Greenleaf, which was a place in Winter Haven, Florida, where the tour school was. David Ledbetter had his first school, and he gave me my first lesson. And then I got very curious. I moved down there to be with him. He was a top teacher, teaching Nick Price and then later Nick Faldo. But my mistake was not staying consistent with what I did. I changed an awful lot. I got driver yips early on, Eamon, from thinking about my swing too much. My arms would ache every morning when I got up, thinking about my swing and how far offline I was hitting balls. And finally kind of narrowed it down, but I had some great teachers over my life. I don't think I'd do it over again. If I was telling somebody that I was trying to coach, I wouldn't do it the way I did, but every experience I had was valuable. And I did. I think I paid over 75 different instructors for lessons. I'm sure I missed a few on that long list, but the statute of limitations expired. If somebody's taught me and I haven't paid them, I'm not paying them anymore.
Well, there's a rumbling of expectation for Rory McIlroy this season. As you know, what are you expecting out of Rory McIlroy?
Well, he had across the board the most consistent year of his career. I thought some of the comments that he's made to the press about how much of a complete player he's become and how many different ways that he won. And if you look at Hall of Famers and particularly Tiger Woods, the best player of our time, he would win when he didn't have his A game. And I think that's what Rory was saying is, you know, previously he would always win from his domination from tee to green. And he said several times this year he won when parts of his game were a little bit wayward, and he won with good iron play. He won with scrambling around the green, and he won a few times with how well he putted. I'm proud, you know, to be part of his team because he's such a great man. And he had his best putting statistics of his life at the age of 32 and 33. So I would expect the same great play from Rory going forward. I know he thinks the same thing. Every part of his game looks good. I don't think he's struggling to look at things that he has to do a lot better. As a matter of fact, I'm sure he's not. And if he just stays on the same course that he's been on, he's going to be tough to beat.
Brad, Rory's been front and center in a lot of the controversy around this game in terms of the division that's in the golf landscape these days. You competed against Greg Norman. You've known him a long time. You've worked with him. I'm curious if your relationship with him has changed over the last few years or how you look upon the division that's out there in the golf world these days.
I mean, Greg Norman was a huge influence in my life, Eamon. He was very helpful along with Ian Baker Finch and going down there to Australia. That was at the Australian Open at Metropolitan when I had that red shirt on. I played with him the first two rounds, won that tournament. We worked together at Fox Sports. He actually lives at Old Palm Golf Club where I live now. I haven't seen him in a couple of years since the start of the Live Golf. I don't think he'd be very happy if he saw me right now because I've been pretty adamant that I don't like what Liv is trying to do to work against the PGA Tour. And go back to your question about Rory. I mean, Rory's had, you know, a burden on his shoulders for, you know, helping the PGA Tour to recreate really itself and how they're moving forward. And I think you've seen it with these 20 designated events. You're going to see the best players in the world playing together more often. And I think he got solace between the ropes where he was able to focus on his golf. And I think a lot of players, great players over their lives, had distractions. You know, Arnold Palmer had so many hobbies like flying airplanes. Greg Norman did that as well. Jack Nicklaus liked to fish and hunt, spend time with his family. And those are the things that can help a golfer so they're not consumed with just their golf game all the time.
It seems to be a theme among a lot of veterans objecting to live, presumably out of loyalty to the PGA Tour. I'm curious, is there a sentiment among veterans that in any way resent the bucket loads of money that is now being thrown at top players on the PGA Tour?
You know, there always has been. When I started off, I think that the players in my generation, I'm 61 years old, you know, when I started playing with players like a Tom Weisskopf, Tom Watson, they thought it was ridiculous what they were making compared to, say, Jack Nicklaus or Sam Snead or Ben Hogan, and that kind of jumps forward, and it's kind of relative to each of those generations, isn't it? You know, where you can see Nicklaus won his 82 tournaments and only made $5 million plus career earnings, and now guys finish, you know, you can win two tournaments in a season and win that much money in just two events. So everything's skewed, but still the importance of winning major championships, winning bigger field, you know, stronger field events. I think that's where players, you know, will be measured at the end, not by just their earnings. And there's always going to be that jealousy. It's amazing how it's changed over the years. And now we, you know, we can stand against the best team sports in the world and say, hey, at least, you know, you look at the top 20 players in the world and what they made on the course. And, you know, I think golfers make as much money off the course as any other athletes. It's getting pretty close.
We started this conversation, Brad, by looking at your 2001 victory at Sony. When you look at your career in full, what are you most proud of? What are you most disappointed in?
I think that playing for a long time, you know, I got out of college. I graduated from school in 4 years. I was one of the few players that was able to graduate 4 years, get their card on the first try and never lose it. Jay Haas did that. Peter Jacobs did that. There's not a handful of guys that did it. I won a tournament in 1986 and 2005. That's a long span to have played well for. Made those two Ryder Cups, represented my country, and, you know, played some good golf. I don't know. I'm just proud. I love the game. Love my dad. I love, you know, everything about being involved, you know, whether it's with Rory or now with NBC Golf. It means a lot.
Brad, you mentioned earlier your dad's facing some health challenges. When we played together a few years ago down in Jupiter, he delivered some fairly gold standard trash talking that I could only ever aspire to. How is he doing now?
Well, he's been moved out of the hospital back home to his home right now. He's in a hospice bed, a hospice care now. He's the strongest guy I know. I hope he surprises everybody that he knows and that we know, and makes this a strong stance. When I told him I was going to go on with you, Eamon, he had the biggest smile. He said some words that we can't say on television. I think I learned from him how to be a competitor, never give up. I love the adjective for a golfer, grinder. I would certainly put that with Rory. He never quits. He makes a cut when he has to on a Friday afternoon. And Tiger is certainly the same way. But I felt like I never quit. So I don't know if I answered that question well.
Your parents raised a terrific golfer and, more importantly, a terrific man, Brad. We're thinking about you and your father. Thanks so much for joining us today. Let's welcome in our good buddy, Mark Rolfing. We joke, Rolf, it's Rolf Channel these 2 weeks. How much is your phone buzzing with questions from players and caddies? I mean, seriously, looking for information.
My phone goes off all the time for information. The best one last week was I got a request to know if I knew the bathroom code to the restrooms over on Lanai. Some guys were over there playing. But yeah, it's a labor of love for me, and I can help them. I can help more at Kapalua than I can here. Frankly, pretty simple formula here for Wailea and being successful, and that is drive the ball in the fairway and make a lot of putts.
Mark, let's jump back to last week for a moment, the Century Tournament of Champions at Kapalua. It was the first of these designated events on the PGA Tour. I'm curious, we'd been through this period where the top players weren't showing up there as much. Did you sense that it had changed, or is it hard to change the atmosphere of an event that's already elite players in a small field?
It's not hard to change the atmosphere, and all you have to do is change the importance of the tournament. And really, all of the credit there, I believe, is due to the PGA Tour and the sponsor Century, because frankly, as you well know, Eamon, we were having a lot of problems a decade ago, struggling, players were skipping, we were changing sponsors left and right, and now everything is settled. I can't overemphasize the job that Century has come in and turned it now into one of the most important golf tournaments in the world. And I will tell you that last week, that putting green in the afternoons was jam-packed. You wouldn't have seen one guy out there 3 or 4 years ago in the afternoon practicing. But it was a whole different mindset amongst the players. You could sense it from the beginning of the week. And that tournament now is just on a rocket ship trajectory.
And it's a very different challenge this week, Mark. How much of an adjustment is it for both player and caddy to go from the challenge and the playing conditions at Kapalua to what they have here at Wailea?
It's an adjustment, Eamon. The biggest one is the elevation changes over there. I think it's 470 feet, I think, from top to bottom. Here it's probably 4.7 feet. So this is really, really flat. You don't get a lot of side hill eyes. But interestingly enough, you have a lot of players that play well in both of those tournaments. You've got a number of guys that have won in both. Ernie Els, Jim Furyk, Zach Johnson has won in both, and, of course, Justin Thomas. And if you look at the guys' records playing at Wailea, the guys who have played Century the week before play much better here because you get used to things like time difference and grass and just the whole island vibe that you got to deal with. And so there's a huge advantage, I think, to playing Century the week before Sony.
Speaking of JT, 6 years ago today, he shot 59 at Wailea. 59 is great anywhere, but how good is that round of golf considering the claustrophobic nature of some of the holes and only two par fives?
Yeah, I think the key there, Damon, is there's only two par fives, so 59 is incredible with only two of those holes that are kind of gimme birdies. I don't think you're going to see anybody scare that this week. I might get surprised, but right now we've got about a 10-mile-an-hour wind coming from the south, actually, sort of the southeast, very strange direction. But Wailea doesn't need a lot of wind. It only needs 10 or 15 miles an hour to play tough, and I think we're seeing it out there now. These are the most demanding fairways, I think, to hit on the PGA Tour. The rough is high, maybe not quite as thick as in some past years where it would have been a little wetter coming into tournament week, but it's a totally different test. Driving accuracy is not a relevant stat at Kapalua, really, but it's the most important stat this week, I think, maybe except for putting.
Mark, we always start the year in Hawaii. Golf fans are accustomed to seeing it there, and that's not something that's ever likely to change. And Hawaii is now the first of these designated events going forward on tour. Do you think the rest of the schedule is likely to change? Because if designated events start to rotate between some tournaments as we go from year to year, that raises the possibility of those tournaments moving on the calendar to just keep some kind of balance. Are we close to seeing the end of, say, a West Coast swing and a Florida swing and maybe a little more randomness in terms of where the tour actually goes on a week-to-week through the first half of the year?
I think we are, Eamon. I'm not sure the West Coast swing will stay intact or the Florida swing. You know, in today's world, whether one tournament is 1 week in Tampa and the next week in Orlando really doesn't matter that much. And frankly, it's all whether or not there's opportunity in that particular date. For example, Sony, you know, has a built-in problem on the weekend here, and that is NFL, you know, playoff games. And so the question is, could it ever become a designated event on a rotating basis? That would be difficult in this date. So I don't know the answer, but I think, Eamon, it is likely you will see this schedule break up a little bit and Jay Monahan and the rest of the tour staff putting together a schedule where the right tournaments fit at the right time for both the sponsor and the community that they're in.
Mark, I have to admit, you speak of the marine life in Hawaii with the ease that you talk birdies and bogeys. How did that interest in the ocean life develop?
I don't know. I guess I'm a Pisces. I grew up in Chicago, and Lake Michigan was a little too cold to go in. But when I'm away, you know, if I'm on a 5 or 6 week trip to the mainland, the one thing that I really miss and the first thing I do when I get back here is go into the water, you know, as quickly as I can. And I will tell you this, we're on the air here now in about an hour. We're off at 5:30, and before that sun goes down, I will be right out there.
There's no Hawaii swing without the voice of Mark Rolfing. We'll hear you at 7 p.m. Eastern time. Enjoy the day, buddy. All right, folks, still to come on Golf Today. A special event is coming up at the end of the month on the APGA Tour. The Farmers Insurance Invitational features 18 of the best minority golfers in the country. Will be broadcast right here on Golf Channel. Andrew Walker is in the field and joins us next. Back on Golf Today, the APGA Tour, established in 2010 as a nonprofit organization with the mission to bring greater diversity to the game of golf. Now, later this month, its season kicks off at Torrey Pines with a 36-hole Farmers Insurance Invitational, which features an elite field of 18 players. The final round airing on Golf Channel on Sunday, January the 29th. And Andrew Walker will be one of those notable names teeing it up at Torrey. Strong career at Michigan State, and has since made the move to the APGA Tour. A fantastic 2022, 17 starts. Got a very important win at the Cisco Invitational at Baltusrol. Baltusrol will host the KPMG Women's PGA Championship in 2023. Three top 10 finishes, three top threes for Andrew Walker. And you see the tweet coming out congratulating him. Thank you, Cisco, for hosting an incredible event. We appreciate your support and commitment to bringing greater diversity to the game of golf. And also caught the attention of Billy Horse, who's been a big-time supporter of the APGA. Congrats, Andrew. Love to see Cisco continue to support the APGA Tour. And we got Andrew Walker joining us on this Thursday. Thanks for your time. First of all, how do you prepare for a week like this with the TV cameras and the tough test that is Torrey Pines?
You prepare. I like to think I prepare just like I prepare for any other event. Of course, it's a big event, you know, starting the year with what's equivalently, you know, one of our majors on the APGA Tour with our invitationals. Kind of go in there with a clean mindset and, you know, look to get the year started off right. Definitely putting in the same prep that I've put in throughout the entire year last year. And hopefully my game's going to be ready.
Andrew, I want to go back and look at your results from last year, because this is a striking consistency here. You made 17 starts out there. You had a first, you had a second, you had a third, you had 10 top tens. You know, you're in the top 25 15 times. What do you look at this year as the next level that you want to play at? What are the goals this year? Because you set some pretty high bars last year.
Yeah, definitely saw some improvements in consistency in my game last year. And I think my stats kind of speak to that. But I definitely want to see that wins tally go up a mark or two. I think my game's definitely, the consistency is there for sure. And I just want to see that really solid play being able to go deep at courses like Torrey Pines, courses like Baltusrol, being able to, you know, transfer and transition my game onto those high-level courses. That's kind of the step I'm trying to take this year and what I'm looking forward to seeing.
Let's talk about Baltusrol. That's some serious major championship DNA. Jack a couple of times. Phil, what did that experience teach you?
It taught me a lot. It taught me what your game needs to have in order to perform at the highest level. And I think coming through with my game holding up down the stretch, because if you look at that scoreboard, it definitely came down to the stretch. But being able to deliver under pressure, in pressure situations on a championship venue course, I learned a lot about that at that specific tournament. And Baltusrol is an amazing place, you know. Looking forward to going back there again this year seeing that course again, because it really was a beauty.
Let's jump ahead to the event at Torrey Pines, the Farmers Invitational. What's a good week for you out there? What are the expectations?
Expectations, well, for one, I'm excited to go back there. I haven't been back there since I was a junior playing in like the Callaway Worlds way back when. So excited to see Torrey again, see it in a different light. I'll definitely be playing back on the tee boxes this time, which will be different. But I'm looking forward to, you know, being able to find out how to plot my way around the golf course. That's kind of my game plan. I'm not the longest hitter, but not the shortest. But I definitely want to see how my game's going to fit the course. And the 2 days of prep work going into the tournament is definitely going to be where I'm looking to do that at.
I know your focus is on the golf, but what's the importance of companies like Farmers and Cisco supporting the APGA?
It's invaluable, to say the least. It's to have corporate sponsors, corporate backing, and groups of people being able to meet the people that work at these companies, and just seeing how involved and how vehemently they want to see guys like me and the rest of the guys out on the APGA Tour succeed and take that step to the next level. It's awesome. It really feels like, you know, we're out here playing this very individual game, but it feels like we have a whole village behind us, trying to make sure that we succeed and are able to chase our dreams to the fullest extent we possibly can. So it's very, 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 very appreciated by all of us.
Andrew, we can see by the results that you've racked up that you have the game and the APGA provides the opportunity. But what would your pathway look like in this game if it wasn't for the APGA Tour?
It would look very, very different, that's for sure. I've, like I said, I've been playing on the APGA Tour for a year now. Last year was my kind of debut, my rookie year, and played a year on what was the Form Tour before that. And my experiences were just very different. Being able to play at that level, I think I learned a lot on PGA Tour Canada Form Tour. But then transitioning into the APGA Tour kind of goes back to what I was talking about with the corporate sponsors. It feels like there's a lot of people behind you. It feels like everybody you're going out and playing against every single week. Of course, you're trying to beat them. We're all competitors out there, but you also want to see them succeed. And I don't think that's a vibe or a sense of camaraderie that you get on other tours. And it's awesome to be able to be a part of it, for sure.
So you're rocking the Panama hat. You also wear it when you play, but I know the meaning goes beyond fashion. What does it represent?
Mm-hmm. It represents where I came from. I wear this hat because of my dad. I wear this hat because my dad wore it because of his dad. I've been wearing this hat since I was like 8 years old, but it's just a constant reminder of why I go out and play golf. It speaks to my family, speaks to the reasons why I fell in love with the game and the reasons why I continue to pursue it to this day. It's definitely a token of where I came from.
Well, the hat looks strong. The game is strong. Best of luck at Torrey. I'll be on the call. I hope I get to say the name Andrew Walker quite a bit. Thanks for the time, pal.
Yes, sir. Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, and a reminder as we go to break, the APGA Tour's Farmers Insurance Invitational will be broadcast live on Golf Channel Sunday, January the 29th.